This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Our guest is the Poet Laureate of the State of Kentucky, Frank X. Walker, and he's here with an opening poem. Here's Frank.
Kentucky Fried. Who really believes that the best fried chicken came from an old white man? When governors, squires, and colonels ain't cooked shit else ever. Where's their famous recipe for red velvet cake, homemade yeast rolls, or finely ground chicken apple sausage? How you stumble upon 13 different herbs and spices and ain't never licked nothing but your fingers or your plate? Does a lot not said when you say this is an old family recipe? Who really believes all the cooking required to coax corn to sour mash and the wisdom to let it rest in charred oak barrels was something ever left up to amateurs? Who else talks to plants and recognizes their medicinal value? Who else sees the effects of peach brandy, wines, and bourbons and got enough sense to call them spirits? Who really believes an old white man discovered a chicken recipe anywhere else but from over a black woman's shoulder who didn't even get a credit for wringing his neck?
That is Frank X. Walker, and don't you ever forget it. He is the Poet Laureate of Kentucky, and he has also changed the landscape there to be Afro-Latchian. Am I right?
I think some people say that was pushing it a little bit, but I did give birth to a word.
Yes, you did.
That allows people of color to be included in conversations about the region.
And the literary journal Pluck furthers your cause, and I think it's making history. I think it's spreading out. So what does the Poet Laureate do?
Well, this former laureate, my term is already over, but mostly I celebrated literature and poetry specifically, tried to impact literacy opportunities and issues in the state, visited prisons, juvenile detention centers, libraries all over the state, conferences, schools, had a chance to read more than I usually read, and I usually read a lot every year. But
it sounds like you really did something worth doing, and that you maybe have penetrated worlds the poetry might not otherwise have been reached, do you think?
That's very kind. I'd like to think that if I do anything in the world with poetry, it's create new fans of poetry. You know, one of my favorite stories is a gentleman who came to the Kentucky Book Fair who said to me that he doesn't like poetry and he doesn't buy books, but he keeps buying this darn book and giving it away to people. And he didn't understand why, but he blamed me for it.
And what was the book?
It was my first book, Afro-Latchia.
That is a great story. But then did he know who you were?
Well, he did by then. Uh-huh. This was his third trip to the Kentucky Book Fair.
That is terrific. And so you changed the map a little bit. And so change our hearts. Let us hear some poetry from Frank X. Walker, from his new manuscript. This is a premiere. We are the first audience.
I want to read a poem about my mother, who had very dark skin and suffered a little bit from color issues within our own family because of that. It's called Ink Stains and Watermarks. The color of ink squeezed from walnut holes. She was born too dark to be rocked to sleep at night. Her spine was not really too firm to be cradled and caressed. She was perfectly legible. Her mother was just too hard to read. The car her father was driving did not crash. She did not fly through the windshield before children could be perfect bound. That was not a scar across her forehead. It was her publisher's colophone. It was an exclamation point dotted by her nose. It was the beginning of the sign of the cross. No ex-husbands, just a coffee stain and a slightly visible tear where two pages formerly yoked had been ripped apart. No miscarriage, just a chapter she wrote in haste that her editor rejected. She did not have a stroke while she carried me. She was just teaching me how to be still, to focus on each little sound, to grow up crazy in love with words. So she marked me, and now every time I open a book, I see her smiling face.
Frank X. Walker at the Library of Congress. In a poem in one of your other books, you talk about inheriting her dough-shaped eyes. Is that true?
It's
remember
true.
That? And it touched me very much. This makes me want to go back. Tell us about the little boy, Frank Walker, at age 5. Can you look at him and tell us who you see? What was that little boy like?
He was already in love with books. You know, his mother had taught him to read very early. And books replaced television, replaced toys, replaced friends. They were, in fact, my best friends. And I was attracted to the very large books that took up a lot of space in your arms that you could cradle and fall asleep in. And I think because of that, the first time I went to a library, it was like going to, you know, the Guggenheim.
I know.
And I was so amazed by all those books. I couldn't wait to own my own books, to have my own library. There was something about books that was born there in that space, at her skirt. That's still here.
The books and her skirt. Is that in a poem yet?
Not yet.
There's something about that her skirt and the books. That is a great image. You have said it all there. Frank Walker is at the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. When did the X come into your moniker?
During college. During my college years, a time on the planet when I actually had hair and I wore glasses that looked a lot like Malcolm X glasses, a lot of my friends nicknamed me X. And I also appeared in a play where I played Malcolm X. And when I had my glasses on and I had hair, people thought I looked like Malcolm. So the X became part of what people called me, and I started using the X when I was also a visual artist. So when I was making art versus being a writer, to separate the two people from each other, I use the X to recognize the writer.
And also, we must tell the audience that the X represents all those people, all the ancestors, all the slaves who could not write. And that's why Malcolm X wanted to add that name to his. You are well known for doing historical research using the actual words said by your characters and then riffing off of that. So I want to just take us back to York for a moment and Medgar Evers, your previous books. So tell us who York was. First of all, the persona is your shining star. Nobody does it better. It is your way of saying something that is beyond words, that we can't say with words. We have to make a person to say them. So just quickly tell us who York was.
Well, York was the, unfortunately, invisible part of the Lewis and Clark expedition. Most people grow up learning and believing that it was just Lewis and Clark, not 42 people, including a 15-year-old Native American woman and an African-American man who was owned by William Clark, both of whom contributed mightily to the success of the expedition, but rarely given credit for it in the modern versions of the story of Lewis and Clark. So
I just wanted to recommend this book because we have actual actual phrases from Lewis and Clark, and then we have words in response to the real reality, the real experience by William.
In the book, I actually use excerpts from the actual journals.
That's what I wanted to say.
The exposition kept, you know, 5 members kept details, drew maps, collected, you know, pictures and plants.
And then with Medgar Evers, how did you approach that book as a persona?
It was a little different. I wanted to do Medgar Evers in a way that was more challenging than with York. With York was just one man speaking, retelling the whole story. With Medgar Evers, I didn't allow Medgar to speak. You know, I thought Medgar's voice was almost cliched by now because you could Google him and pull up his voice and hear his story. But I wanted everybody else to tell Medgar's story. So the major speaker in Medgar's life and the book is the assassin, Byron De La Beckwith. Additional voices include De La Beckwith's wives, his first and second wife, Wilma and Thelma, and the voice that kind of balanced out the darkness that the assassin brought to the table was Merle Evers, the widow. Megha's brother, Charles, also speaks. And then there's another voice that acts like a chorus, like a Greek chorus that fills in the blanks to history, that allows people to get the story, even if they don't know the history of civil rights in America.
I want to recommend Turn Me Loose, The Unghosting of Medgar Evers. I want to recommend The Journey of York, which is about the expedition, Lewis and Clark expedition. And now I want to recommend our new work, Frank X. Walker. Let's hear the new book. What is the title?
There's a third book about the York story that I'm going to read from, but the poems I've been reading today so far all come from Ink Stains and Watermarks,
right?
An upcoming collection. I want to share a poem that is a response to one of my favorite poems in the world. Yusef Komunyakaa has a well-known poem called Facing It about the Vietnam Memorial. And every time I visit that memorial, I think about other memorials and what's happening around the country regarding trying to open the conversation about monuments to the Confederacy. And in Georgia, there's a huge monument at Stone Mountain that venerates the Confederacy. And I went to visit it to do research. And I tried to imagine, what would a biracial kid, you know, his parents were much like Barack Obama, what would they feel and think and believe in that space of, if they were familiar with Yusef Komunyakaa's Facing It and how he treated that particular poem. So I wrote this called Defacing It, after Yusef Komunyakaa. My southern heritage heavies, deflecting carved faces in white rock. I said I wouldn't, damn it, no sweat. I'm stoned, I'm flushed. My apparent reality parades me as a bird of paradise, a son of the South, passing, trained against mourning. I turn away, the truth won't let me go. I turn them away, and I am Stone Mountain, the Confederate soldier's memorial, again, dependent upon DNA to know the difference. I research eight generations of my family tree, half expecting the black to seep through like smoke. My eyes touch the mane of the horse under Stonewall Jackson. I see the booby trap of white flesh. Buttons shimmer on an open blouse. She can't walk away, and the stain stays in us all, gives rise to the clan, igniting seasons of ever strange fruit. The tree, a noose in the tree. My great-grandfather's face floats closer to me, then his green eyes stare into mine. Now she's a widow, and he has exercised his right to bear arms. In the white mirror, a woman is trying to change our name. No, she's relaxing my grandmother's hair.
Frank Walker, what I feel about your work is that you don't set out to persuade or convert. You just have the confidence of your truth. And this confidence lets you just tell a story, and that story will be a raft that will carry us through, and it will carry us to the other side. There's not a lack of kindness in you either. You tell the story as bitter and painful as it is, and you let that truth work for you. Let's hear another.
Thank you. I do a lot of school visits, and I'm going to read a poem that is in response to visiting a group of middle school kids whom I had been tricked into spending time with. I was invited initially to see a small class, a small group of boys, and I arrive at the school. They take me to the gym, and it's the stands are full of kids. There might be a couple of hundred young boys, and I think they put all the kids who were troublemakers in the school and put them in the gym, and they ran out of the room and left me with them. And it was almost a contentious meeting in the beginning, but I had to do some things to kind of, you know, break the ice and to connect with them, which I felt like I did, and I was invested in that. So I wanted to write about that. It's called Monarchy for the Princes at Second Street School. They glare at me with their nostrils flaring, then avert their gaze when I don't wilt. They puff out bony chests, spread their shoulders like lizards do in the wild, needing to scare off a would-be predator. But I step even closer, let them feel my presence, let them measure themselves against all the space I claim. In the blink of an eye, I tell them I am a man, black, that I recognize their bullshit, smelled it on their breath as soon as I walked into the room. There are no other black men in this space, so they have filled it with faux braggadocio, fueled by the smell of their own piss, have laid claim to the space by default. The teachers, all young and white and undertrained, fear them, fear their hair, their clothes, their music, their shoes, their body language, fear any and everything that smells like confrontation, simmers like unmedicatable rebellion, and looks like the 6 o'clock news. But I'm not trading in fear. I'm only afraid that they have been in captivity so long they won't recognize my scent. I pace back and forth and show my teeth. I lean in like alpha males do. I need them to understand that we are from the same pride, and I'm here to show them what they will look like when their manes grow in. For 90 minutes, I become the father they never had. I'm the core standing behind their mothers, even the ones who are white, insisting that they listen to me, the women who gave birth to them, their teachers, everyone responsible for the futures, lest they have none. I am the disciplinarian promising consequences for their unacceptable behavior, push back for their initial disrespect, held to pay for their indifference, remedies for their short attention spans, directions and roadmaps for their yet unrealized dreams, but only because I love them. Mm. I love their potential. I love their wide-eyed promise. I love their well-masked fears. I say all of this without ever opening my mouth, with a gentle hand on every shoulder, with serious eyes and a don't test me smile. Whenever I arrive any place with a room full of cubs, and I am the only lion.
I love that. You're a professor at the University of Kentucky.
I am.
And I want everyone to know who you are. You were the vice president of the Kentucky Center, and you were the executive director of the Governor's School for the Arts, the author of Afflalatia, a founding member of the Afflalatian Poets. You were also a member of Cave Canem with the good people, Toy Derricotte and
Cornelius
Eady. And you have received the Lannan Literary Fellowship and the Lillian Smith Book Award, and this is just the beginning. This is just the beginning for you. Talking about teaching, what would you think would be the one thing that your students take away from you as a professor? When they walk out, what do you believe they think about you?
That I mean it. That I mean everything I say to them in the classroom, and that I want to be there, that it's not just a job, that I believe, even more committed in the classroom than I am when I'm working on my own, trying to craft a poem.
So that's your mission. That's
teaching.
Your mission. Communication and teaching, yeah. Let's have another poem, because we can't get enough of it. Frank X. Walker, this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri.
This poem is actually part of a larger project that is connected to tattoos. And it's a tribute and gift that's about how much like the world women are, and particularly the black women in my life. So it's a tribute to both of them. It's called Love Letter to the World.
Before you begin, we have to say that that's a YouTube, and they can look at that. They can look at the tattoos and poetry. So how would we do that? It would be YouTube, Frank X. Walker Tattoos, Love Letter to the World?
Any of that, I think, would
get
you there.
Okay, get you there. Okay, now we can hear the words that go with the visual.
I love you, world. Love your seven different faces. Love your healing waters wide and deep. Love the thing you have with the sun and the moon and what it teaches us about companionship, about change, about revolution. Love the mirror at your navel, how it shows off your hemispheres, illustrating important lessons about balance, about reflection, about centering ourselves. Love how much like little worlds we are, how our earthquake is your shiver, your sneeze a tsunami, an avalanche, a mudslide. When you have hot flashes, we call it drought. You once covered your whole body with ice to cool a fever. When you weep daily over our continued ignorance, our epic failures and petty squabbles, our every transgression, your waters break and we are born again. Love your outreach, our mutual attraction, your gravitational pull. For every treasure we steal from your womb, you send us hail and thunderstorms. When we invent poisons and no antidotes, and build monuments to ourselves, you send tornadoes and hurricanes to remind us of how small we truly are. And yet, Every day you continue to humble, inspire, and move us to tears with your natural beauty. Our only efforts to mimic your vistas are what we dare call art and dance, and music and poetry, architecture and language and love. It is the only thing we have ever gotten right. We can't pass the course on humanity if we keep failing the lessons on harmony and until we unlearn fear and hate. Thank you, world, for this open book exam before us, for still believing we are worthy of your love. We, who love you black, already know that everything we do to you, we also do to ourselves.
That's our poet today at the Library of Congress. What is your daily practice in writing?
Well, this time of the year, I'm trying to do a lot of reading. But I'm a morning writer and morning person. And
me too.
I get up before, you know, I'm racing the garbage man to the curb to to unlock all that, those secrets that are sitting out there waiting to be written.
Every day?
Well, I get up early every day. And I believe I'm involved in the writing process, even when I'm reading. You know, I consider that research or editing or just thinking about something I've been mulling over all night in my head. But
so discipline to you means being a disciple too.
Oh, absolutely.
So every day you do this in a certain time of day, no matter what it is, whether you're just sitting and thinking, looking at the ceiling, scribbling, editing. What time is that?
I wake up every morning at 4:30 without an alarm. I've done that for most of my adult life, partially because I'm one of 11, and it was the only quiet time in our house when I was a kid.
Where were you in that constellation?
I'm the oldest male and the second one out of the oven.
Whoa, you were born with a responsibility on your shoulders, and you are still carrying it.
Still carrying them and theirs, it seems.
Oh, my, what a great, glorious gift. And I know that you can do it. So please let us hear more from that other part of you, the artist.
I'm going to read a poem that I mentioned earlier that's from the third collection in the York Chronicles. And this is York 10 years out the expedition. And he's going back out west to visit the Native American family that he connected with when he was there. And now he's traveling by himself. And he's learning to listen to nature in a different way. And he's been traveling so long, he's now starting to hear the music that's alive in the world that he hadn't thought of as music before. And in this particular poem, he hears things that remind him of things he'd heard in his past back on the plantation. So this is called Music as Medicine. And York is a speaker. Listening to crickets and other crawling things find a part in the night song. Put me in mind of Sundays in the quarter and how my people sitting round and feeling empty might slowly gather together in the space of each other's breath to sing. How they always build a song that might start with a steady hand on a thigh, a heavy foot or a solid stick setting down a heartbeat that everybody can lean into with their eyes closed before stacking other sounds right on top of it. Might be a well-timed hand clap or a moan. Might be the rattling sound of a mess of dry beans or corn in a wooden bowl. Any kind or size wood on wood can speak truth, can scratch, click, or clack. Anything under the right hand can say doom doom, can say out loud how you really feel. And when that song start rising, everybody of every age can't help but join in. Mothers rocking babies and humming. Old folks nodding heads, young feet kicking up their heels and toes in the dirt or just dragging them to the music our living together make. As it rises and rises to everybody who felt empty, now feel full.
We should tell the audience that from one of your previous books, I get that Clark lied and said that York had died during the expedition, but that York did not, and he lived to become part of an Indian, a Native American group, right? Maybe a chief.
Well, there are many versions of the story. The official one that historians accept, because it was written down by William Clark after an interview, is that he died in the mountains of Tennessee on his way back to him to become his slave again, which is crazy to me. The other story is that he went back out west to live among the Native Americans.
Which is what this poem tells us.
Yes, with whom he had children. I've actually had the pleasure of being on the Nez Perce Reservation and dining with descendants of York. And they are proud of that association. In their transcribed oral history, they talk about the courtship between York and the chief's daughter and the son that they produced, also named York. And those descendants are still recognized and alive and well-known inside the tribe.
And you keep the story on. And we would like a final poem.
This final poem is for my fellow poets out there, particularly a group of poets I've fallen in love with as a family, for Chris, April, McKinley, and especially Shauna. This is called Teaching New Poets to Hunt. I invited them along, hoped they'd like the chase, knew they'd recognize the scent of irony, indecision, and isolation in their own backyards, knew they'd hunt down their private thoughts, obsessions, and unspoken fears one by one. I believed they could survive in the wild, would build warm fires and shelter from their own childhood memories, would pull ribs from their own breasts and forge new weapons and tools. I showed them how to track game downwind, how to not get burned from the fire in their lungs after wringing a wild thing's neck with their bare hands, how to always eat the liver first, to hold the quivering heart in their hands until the last beat. I propose that we display the carcasses and pelts here in our common space, that we not judge each other's efforts, but only be inspired by the body counts, by the ritual of spilling blood every day. Now, I look at them and nod my head with approval, proud to have encouraged the slaying of such beautiful, ugly things well before they hunted us down and tried to kill us first.
The voice of Frank X. Walker. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions. Post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making this program possible. Funding is provided by the Witter Binner Foundation for Poetry and the Reva and David Logan Foundation. And Friends of Poetry, Hiram LaRue, and Diane Welbin Parks. Our engineer is Mike Turpin. I'm Grace Cavalieri.